This meeting of the House Resource Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:02 p.m., Monday, February 10, 2025, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Colomb, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Rauscher, Representative Elam, and myself, Co-Chair Burke. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Before we begin, again, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the House Resources Secretary for from Records, and Dennis Fukushima from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. And Record Representative Sadler joined us at 1:02 p.m. In committee today, we will hear North Slope production updates from ConocoPhillips, ConocoPhillips Alaska, Santos, and Hillcorp Alaska. We greatly appreciate the three companies taking this time to share this information with the committee today. Up first, we have Barry Romberg and Ben Carlson from ConocoPhillips. Mr. Romberg and Mr. Carlson, please come forward and put yourself on record and begin your presentation. And throughout the presentation, we'll go through, finish a slide, and if there are any questions, then committee members may ask any questions that they may have.
Perfect. Sounds good.
Oh, sorry. Let me just move the mic closer to me.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Burke and members of the committee. My name is Barry Romberg, for the record. I'll briefly introduce my colleague, Ben Carlson, here, and then I will take the first half of our presentation and let Ben do the second half.
Ben Carlson, ConocoPhillips Alaska, VP Finance and IT, and happy to be here.
Thank you.
Okay, so for the record, my name is Barry Romberg. I'm Vice President of Commercial and Midstream for ConocoPhillips Alaska. By way of background, I'm accountable for a few different things for our business unit here, economic evaluations, business development, land, natural gas marketing. I'm also the president of our five pipeline companies, and we'll talk a little bit about that today. And I oversee our marine transportation operations as well with our five polar tankers. Earlier in my career, I was a U.S. Coast Guard officer in Valdez, and I worked for Alaska Pipeline as an operations manager for a few years before Phillips, and I've been with ConocoPhillips now for about 20 years. So by way of an agenda, we've got some information we'll share with you today about our assets in Alaska, some specifics on some North Slope projects. We'll also share some of the ways we approach sustainability and community investment. And primarily be available for your questions, should you have any, about our operations in Alaska. But first, we are a publicly traded company, so this is a standard disclaimer we have to show you. Really, it basically says that we're going to make some forward-looking statements today, and you shouldn't use any of this information on to make investments in the market. Okay, so a little bit about ConocoPhillips Global Operations. We are the largest independent exploration and production company in the U.S., and by independent, what I mean there is that as of 2012, we split with a company called Phillips 66. They took all of our downstream and refining part of the business, and really ConocoPhillips is focused on the upstream, which is exploration, finding, and developing oil projects, just like we have here in Alaska. We also hung on to our pipelines. So we've got several pipelines I'll show you on a map, and then, of course, we're a 30% owner in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. In a nutshell, we explore for oil. We work very hard to invest our capital efficiently to produce oil for the benefit of landowners and our shareholders. And as you see here on the slide, we operate in 14 different countries around the world, and we have almost 12,000 employees. Any questions on this one before I move on?
I don't see anything.
Hearing none. So we'll talk a little bit about our Alaska operations, and then I'll show you a map next.
I apologize.
We've got one. Okay.
Can we go back one slide,
sure.
And Representative
Absolutely.
Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Mr. Romberg. Just, I did see a flag in China. Just curious, what's Conoco's operations in China?
Sure. Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, we have a non-operated business there now in Bohai Bay. So we do oil and gas extraction in a partnership with the Chinese government there. But,
Where's Bohai?
Ben, you've been there, haven't you?
Indeed, I have not. No, it's somewhere on the East Coast.
Yeah, so if you're looking at the map here, it's just inland from Japan.
Yeah. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Please proceed.
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about our operations in Alaska. So you're going to hear more about Prudhoe Bay today from our friends at Hillcorp, but we are a 36.5% working interest owner of Prudhoe Bay. We are a 99% owner of the Kuparuk River unit, and we own a full 100% of all of the units out west of that, which we refer to as the Western North Slope, and I'll show you that on the map in the next slide. The Western North Slope is the Colville River unit, Greater Moose's Tooth unit, and the Beartooth unit, which is where the Willow Project's located. We also own 30% of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and we have ownership and operatorship of the 5 tankers we use to move oil from Valdez to the West Coast. We have a little more than 1,100, actually close to 1,200 employees here in the state through our operated assets of Kuparuk and the Western North Slope. And through, of course, our ownership in Prudhoe Bay, we produce nearly half of the oil that travels down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline today. And, of course, that will increase with Willow. Now, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this slide and kind of go through the map for you, talk about the assets, and I'll finish with then coming back around through the pipelines that connect all of this to TAPS. So starting in the upper left, that's, of course, Prudhoe Bay. It's a gigantic oil field still producing the most of any of the units up on the North Slope. As you move to the left of the map, right about the middle there is the Kuparuk River unit. We've been operating that since the early 1980s. And through a series of investments between now and then, we've maintained a very strong base production. That takes a lot of investment dollars and a lot of concentration, but that asset is still producing quite well. As you move further west, you'll hear from my friend at Santos about the Pickup Project, which lies in between Kuparuk and Alpine. We also have a couple projects there that Ben will talk about a little bit at Nuna and Coyote in the upper middle of the chart. And I'll take you further west to the left, where we've got the Alpine Field, which was the first development out in the Colville River unit. That was developed about 25 years ago. And as we move further west, that is the Greater Moose's Tooth unit. And those developments were found many decades ago, but began producing about 7 years ago. And that GMT-1 came online about 7 years ago, and then GMT-2 just several years ago. And we're moving all the way out to the left-hand side now to the Beartooth unit, which is, of course, where the Willow Project's located. We'll talk a little bit more about that and give you some detail on that as we move through. But obviously, a massive investment. We're 100% out there in the MPRA, and certainly a lot more resource out there, both west and south of Willow.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You show me a chart. I'm going to ask you a question. Through the chair, Mr. Brumberg, I see in the legend there's a brown circle and a brown triangle.
Yeah.
That is a central processing facility. Is it the circle or the triangle or both? Help me understand that. I'm not quite seeing anything quite like that.
Yeah. So
the circles, but no.
The circles are developed already, and the triangles are newly developed.
Process facility.
Yep. The circles are existing central process facilities. The triangles are future projects.
Great.
And this map is showing GMT as a future, but those are existing today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Sure.
Are there any other questions?
Sir.
Hearing none.
Thank you. Okay, so what I'll do now is kind of take you from left to right back across the screen and describe our pipeline network that exists up there that is responsible for carrying all of this oil into TAPS, into the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. So under construction right now, as we speak, is the Willow Pipeline, and that goes, of course, from Willow and connects back into the Alpine Pipeline, which is there just to the south of the Colville River unit. The Alpine Pipeline carries that oil to CPF-2, you see right about the middle of your screen there, and that's where the interconnection is into the Kuparuk Pipeline. And the Kuparuk Pipeline is 18 inches as it goes into CPF-1, and then it's a 24-inch pipeline that goes from CPF-1 all the way back into TAPS at Pump Station 1. And this is our network of current North Slope pipelines. So Now that I've cleared the map, just to talk a little bit about ConocoPhillips, kind of general operations and our investments and some of our history. So we are currently the largest producer of oil in the state of Alaska. With Willow coming on in 2029, we will roughly double our production today. I'm going to briefly talk about Nuna and Coyote, and then my colleague Ben here in the second section will go into more detail about them. But Nuna and Coyote are really special projects. You'll hear more from Santos about Pikka. Essentially, you'll see they're in the same trend. Nuna came online in December, so it's producing oil right now as we speak, and Coyote will be coming online in about a year. So why are these special? These are new projects within the Kuparuk River unit, which, as I mentioned, is a 40-plus-year-old oil field. And the thing that's really interesting about the slope is we're in the middle of what I would call a renaissance of Alaskan oil production. There's a few things that have led to this that are really critical. One is for the last decade or more, we've been in a very stable fiscal system. Projects that were envisioned like Nuna and Coyote a decade ago have been able to maintain the same economic assumptions as they did when they were first envisioned. That's extremely important for long-term investment cycles like we make, where sometimes it takes 10 to 20 years to get a project online that you're then betting that will produce for 20, 30, 40 more years. So the stability of really ever since SB21, the main fiscal oil tax system in the state has been stable. So that's critical. The other is that most of these new projects really are adopting horizontal drilling technology that was developed in the lower 48. And 20 years ago, that was not in the plan. So if you go back to before SB21, to the 2011 timeframe, and take a look at the DNR's production forecast for today, for 24 and 25, it'd be less than half of where we're at today. So through this investment, through the stable tax regime, and through the advent of horizontal drilling technologies, we've been able to maintain a very, very stable base production. In fact, we're nearly 500,000 barrels today. If you look at the most recent revenue sources book, 2025 will most likely be the lowest production we'll see in the next 10 years. So that's remarkable. You know, we've been in a state of decline, or at least stabilizing that decline, for the last several decades. And here we are on the cusp of a growth cycle in Alaska, and it's very exciting. So I'll pause here for any questions before I kind of wrap things up.
Representative Sadler, then Representative Elam.
And I guess we'll thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I still don't quite understand the legend here. There's a circle and a diamond that are in brown, and a circle and a diamond that are in blue. Blue's future. So what's the circle represent that the diamond does not?
Yes, so okay. Yes, you're right. Through the chair, yes. Representative Sadler. Yes, so the black is central processing facility or project. And so you read the black as existing circle, a central processing facility, and an existing project is in black there. The blue are yet totally undeveloped.
Yeah. I'm so sorry, sir. The circle and the triangle.
The triangle.
What's the circle that the triangle isn't?
I'm sorry. The black are both existing. So the circle is central processing facility. The triangle is the project. And then on the blue side, those don't exist yet.
I'm so sorry. Right. So the circle is a central processing facility.
Yeah.
The diamond is a...
It's a project. And so through the chair, Representative Sadler, the triangles don't have their own full central processing, and so they're flowing back to a central processing facility. GMT 1 and 2 are flowing through a pipeline to be processed at Alpine in the circle. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Elam?
Thank you. Heard a couple of things there that I was looking for a little clarity on, but it sounds like particularly a couple of these projects just recently – we're looking at first oil from efforts that started a decade ago. And that was the product of a stable environment. Do you have concerns around stability now, or are there things that might be inhibiting their abilities to be able to continue with some of this? Because it looks like there's a lot of options there that are on the cusp of generating, in my mind, significant revenues.
Yeah. So through the chair, Representative Elon. Yes, I think if you look back over the past 20 or 30 years, absent the last 12, there were several different tax systems in place. So since SB 21, there really has been no material change to the way that production tax works for the North Slope. And that's the period of stability I'm talking about. To answer your second question, if there are concerns, always. I think in many other places we operate around the world, the tax system is set by contract that would go for the duration of an oil field's life. As we've seen here in the state of Alaska, changes can be made ongoing, and it is always a challenge for a company to invest billions of dollars in something and have the returns affected by a change in the tax system. That's something that's always a concern to us. We believe that this renaissance of Alaskan oil production is in large part due to the fact that companies have seen 12 straight years or more of the same tax system and can bank on that in the future, or at least our assumptions would say that we're planning on that in the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hall, then Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Romberg, I'm curious to know, maybe I missed it if you already said it, but what is the breakdown of Alaska Hire of the 12,000 employees that you have?
Through the chair, Representative Hall, thank you for the question. So of our base business that we have operating today, of the 1,200 employees we have here, about 80% live in Alaska. If you extend that to the Willow Project, where we've had to pull in a lot of short-term resources, then those numbers drop to about 70% for the Willow Project. Majority Alaskan hire.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Hall.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just quick follow up on that. When it comes to, I guess, hiring, because everything's expanding there for the Willow Project, are you finding any difficulties hiring Alaskans? Or, like, are there any challenges associated with that if you could expand?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Hall. Absolutely. There's challenges finding skilled labor for sure. What we can't find in Alaska, we have to source from the lower 48. But as the numbers would show, our preference, of course, is to hire folks locally. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. And that provides a nice, stable workforce. But as you'll hear from my colleague Ben, there's over 2,000 people on the slope right now working on the Willow Project. So sourcing 100% from Alaska is always a challenge.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Representative Hall. I've got Representative Sadler, Representative Fields, and Representative Elam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Brumberg, I appreciate the investment that you mentioned, the production forecast and the current and future production is very gratifying. That's, in my view, fulfillment of what our goal was in passing SB 21 at this table on the floor. But despite the production forecast and the throughput in the pipeline, the royalty provisions are changing. Could you give us a general outline, kind of for education of the committee and the public, as to the royalty provisions as you move westward from the east, from Prudhoe Bay?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'll do my best. The royalty provisions in each project are not public information. I think the best I could say is that because it depends on each project and each company has a royalty provision that I would not be privy to. I can tell you that the royalty rates as you move from the right-hand side of the screen to the left do increase. And the base level is the historic 1/8, which is 12.5%. That's the minimum. But there are projects out west that have higher royalty rates.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Fields?
Thank you, through the chair. Following up on the issue of Alaska Hire, of course, we all run into employees of Conoco who maybe have relocated here from Houston or other places. And when you are recruiting employees to work here, whether they're incumbent employees or new employees, what do you hear from prospective employees who are considering moving to Alaska? And are there barriers that we can help address, whether that is housing, schools, things like that? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, it's an excellent question. I'm not in HR. I have hired a few folks into my group. I think my comments there might be too narrow to give you a more real full answer. I would volunteer if we could follow up with you maybe with some thoughts around some of the challenges we have, but I unfortunately don't have that information with me today.
Sounds good.
Be happy to follow up.
Thank you, Representative Fields. I've got Representative Elam and then Representative Klum.
Thank you. When we talk about the direct number of employees that ConocoPhillips hires, how many additional support, that support in my district in particular, there's a lot of support industry that are directly related. And I mean, can you speak to what that volume or number looks like? I'm not really fully sure, but I know there's a lot.
Through the chair, Representative Ebelam. I think, it's, again, a great question, and it's been covered a lot in the last couple of decades around various reports around the multiplier effect, as we say, when we have one, say, for instance, ConocoPhillips job, what that means in terms of the direct contractor community and then the benefit to the economics of the state and how many retail and service and support sectors are. Unfortunately, I don't have those numbers in front of me today, but it's substantial. It's a massive effect on the local economy to have even one additional employee here.
Thank you.
Again, we can follow up with you on those numbers. They're pretty well documented in our industry.
Thank you. Next, we'll have Representative Coulombe, and I do have a question. So, but then after that, we'll move on. We're about halfway through a little bit over halfway through the time that we have allotted for you all, and sure. Halfway through the slide. So,
thank you, Chair Burke. Through the chair, I was just curious. I'm not an engineer, but what is the horizontal drilling? What problem is that overcoming, and how many projects use that new technology?
Through the chair, Representative Coulombe. I am an engineer. I don't do a lot of subsurface work, but I think I can provide at least a summary answer to your question. If you think about oil production 80, 90, 100 years ago, you had a vertical well. And everything you're looking up here on the map, there are horizontal segments, layers of oil layered down sediments that have built up over time. And so the ability to extract oil vertically, you're only transecting maybe sometimes 10, 20 feet of an oil layer. Mm-hmm. Through the technology today, you can get a drill bit into a 10 or 20 foot interval and follow it for miles and actually steer it to the point where you're able to make an economic project that just numbers wouldn't have added up in the past. And that when you've seen diagrams of our drill rigs and stretching out 3, 4, 5 miles in some cases, that's what you're looking at, is the ability to reach and to make contact with more oil service than in the past.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Coulombe. My follow-up question was just about, you have almost 1,200 employees that you directly employ. What about how many subcontractors do you have, and how many of them are Alaska-based, I guess, or Alaska hire?
Yeah. Co-Chair Burke, I'll go back to my quote from before. So 80% of our direct employees are Alaska hire, about 70% in the contracting community, especially with Willow. I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
Yes. Yeah. Do you consider subcontractors direct employees or?
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
So how many subcontracted employees do you have, and how many of them are Alaska based?
Okay. So thousands. On the Willow project alone, we'll have 2,400 contractors up on the slope, just out west on that project here in Alaska. Also working on the Willow project are contractors along the Gulf Coast that are building the modules. And then we are, as Ben will talk about, we're spending about $1 billion a year in capital reinvestment outside of Willow, just in developing Kuparuk and Alpine and Greater Roses Tooth. So we can follow up with the exact number today or this year, but it is in the thousands and significantly larger number than our 1,200 employees in the state.
Okay. Thank you. And when you do follow up, could you provide the breakdown of how many are from Alaska and outside of it? Okay. Thank you.
We will do that.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. So that's about what I had for you on this slide. I'm going to make a few comments here and then transition over to my friend Ben. So as a 25-year Alaskan, I'm very proud of my company's commitment to the state, and I want to thank you for your service to this great state. I want to close with just some thoughts about Willow and the size and scale of this project. I think if you take a look around the world, you won't find a company out there willing to invest $8 billion of its own equity, its own capital, at 100% ownership in a single upstream project like this. Not in Alaska, not in Canada, not in the lower 48, potentially around the world where you've got national oil companies that own their oil operations in their country, but no private industry that I've ever seen. And that That's really something. I think that really says something about ConocoPhillips' commitment to the state. We believe in Alaska. We're committed to working with y'all and as partners for the benefit of all Alaskans for decades to come. We've been here from the start with ARCO back in the 70s, 60s and 70s. We're currently fueling these sustaining investments that are necessary to maintain this base production that is currently all the flow down taps. And we're excited to grow into the future with projects like Nuna, Coyote, and Willow. Thank you very much. And at this point, I'll turn it over to my colleague and friend, Ben Carlson.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, Barry, and good afternoon to the committee. And again, we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today. So Barry provided an overview of our company and a high-level look at our footprint across the state. Next, I'm going to provide some detail on our major projects that we have going on right now. I'll talk a bit about how we approach our work, and then I'll touch on some of the economic impacts of our operations here in Alaska. And obviously, Willow has received a lot of the headlines recently, but we do have an active development program across our Alaska acreage. Excluding Willow, we've actually invested more than $1 billion a year on average in capital across our legacy assets. And we plan to invest about $1 billion a year going forward. And again, that's excluding Willow. So that is, it's on legacy acreage, which is primarily state lands. So to get into some of the detail on these other projects, first, Nuna, as Barry referenced. Just before year end, we did announce that we had achieved first oil under budget and ahead of schedule on Nuna at our 3T drill site in Kuparik. Drilling began there back in September, and it's going to continue for the next several years. Another important point on Nuna, the single production module, what we call the SPM, supporting the project, was actually fabricated here at the Port of Alaska in Anchorage. So great to see all of that activity happening right here in the state. Next, WestSac, which is on the eastern side of the Kuparik unit. We've just brought online additional production from WestSac, which is a viscous oil reservoir from a four-pad development that we're developing there, and we've had encouraging early results. But WestSac is also important because it's going to provide us with information on other viscous opportunities, which we'll be able to leverage for future development. And then now to the western part of the Kuparik River unit, Coyote is our next major development. And it's a bit earlier along in its life cycle, but we've begun a drilling program here in 2025 to develop the reservoir to help define the opportunity. And Coyote is going to be a big focus for us in the coming years. And then finally, in the western North Slope, we have our GMT-2 development. So GMT achieved first production in December of 21. Last year, production from GMT-2 averaged 14,000 barrels a day. So that was about 7% of our total North Slope production. And to date, we've completed 25 wells in that reservoir. So all of that to say, we're continuing to deepen our Alaska portfolio through resource maturation and exploration. And we do have a strong pipeline of resource opportunities across our operated assets, which leverage our existing infrastructure, and that's going to help drive growth in the years to come. So I'll pause there and see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Representative Rusher, then Representative Sadler.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I don't know who to ask the question, but while we're looking at a slide talking about Kuparik and what's going on up in the area, so I was wondering if any of you could give me or the committee an update on the Kuparik Road negotiations. Is that
Representative Rusher through the chair? Barry Romberg for the record. So there's been a lot of headlines, so I think I won't repeat necessarily all the detail that has been in the litigation that has come forward. But so the back in 2022, the DNR issued a permit for Santos to use ConocoPhillips roads. That permit was challenged, and if you saw the decision in December, the judge ruled in favor of ConocoPhillips. So we've got that situation out there. But in parallel to that, ConocoPhillips and Santos have been progressing negotiations on a commercial road use agreement. And happy to say that myself and who you'll hear from here from Santos have been working really well together and progressing negotiations. We're at a point where we're very ready, and we're ready to put this behind us. But in parallel, of course, there's an appeal to the Supreme Court on the validity of the permit. So those things are all coming together, but I think I appreciate the question, and I would like to report to the committee anyway that access to the pickup project has never been blocked. We've been working under a temporary agreement that we put in place many, many years ago. And so the projects are working well together and coordinating operations. And really what's going on outside of that is some litigation around the validity of a permit and negotiation around a commercial road use agreement, which would involve a payment. And so I think I'm hopeful that very soon we'll get both of those issues resolved and put that behind us. But in the interim, road traffic is flowing as normal, and everybody's got access to their projects. So,
thank you. Representative Rauscher, I think there'll be an opportunity in the future, at a future hearing, to hear a presentation from DNR and the Department of Law.
Okay.
We'll do Representative Sadler's question, but then we are on page 6 of the presentation, and we've got about 7 minutes left of the time that we have allotted.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll leave my question about the road and follow up to that meeting. But I was, Mr. Carlson, I was intrigued to hear you say that there were promising results from Westsac Viscose Oil. Pardon me. Easier produced oil, you know, is there, and there's a lot of oil there, but it's too thick to produce. Any specific chemical or technical or operational advances that are giving you these encouraging results? Can you speak more about that, because that's intriguing to me?
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, I would defer on that question. I don't have the engineering background to give you the answer that you might like. I don't know if Barry could provide some more detail on that. But
through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'll give you a little bit, but I'd encourage you to ask that of our operator, Prudo, who will be up last. And I think they've really got probably a more detailed story to tell there. So this Westsac area, if I can go back to the map here real quick, is the area that sits between Prudo and Kuparuk in the gray. And historically, that's been a challenged resource. It's been hard to get, and there's been different technologies and tactics necessary to go economically go get that oil. What we collectively have been able to figure out over the last several years is that there is a way to do it. It does involve chemicals and polymer. It also involves really precisely laying out drilling plans and processing in a way that can make that economic. And I'll finish that with, you know, the problem statement for Alaska, or really for anywhere around the world for oil production, is not necessarily where to find the oil. It's where to find it and extract it and get it to market in a way where there's some profit to be made. Because without that, you don't have a project. So,
thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Great. All right. So now focusing on Willow, the North Slope has not seen an effort like this since the development of Alpine 20 years ago. And ConocoPhillips is, of course, very proud to be supporting this investment. Willow is a project that provides economic benefits for Alaskans through job opportunities, through state tax revenues, and it also is a project that enhances U.S. energy security. So going to the slide now, first on the right panel, these are some of the highlights of what we accomplished last year. So 2024 was the first major construction season for the Willow project, and despite the challenging weather that we had early in the season, we did mobilize 1,200 workers for the project, and we were able to accomplish all of the critical scope that we had outlined at the beginning of the year. We also constructed the Willow Operations Center in modules in the Kivit Yard on the Texas Gulf Coast. And those 12 modules made their way via the Panama Canal up to the North Slope. And you can see a picture of the modules there in the right middle photograph. We also laid a significant amount of gravel, constructing 7 miles of new roads. We progressed the construction of our pipelines west from Kuparuk into the MPRA. And we completed the 30-acre pad where the Willow Operations Center is eventually going to live. And we have a picture of the pad there in the lower left. And 2025 is going to be even busier for us. So we'll have 2,400 workers on the slope, so approximately double what we had on the slope last year. And they're going to be progressing a tremendous amount of civil work. We're planning for 350 miles of ice road and 30 miles of pipeline. And importantly, we are going to transport and deliver our 12 Willow Operations Center modules to the 30-acre pad where they will eventually live. So we are off to a promising start this year. We've had favorable weather on the slope, which has allowed us to make strong early progress. And we're, of course, hopeful that that's going to continue. But I'll add that, you know, as ever, we are focused on executing the work safely and responsibly. And at ConocoPhillips, we say that no work is ever so urgent or so important that we can't take the time to do it in a safe and environmentally responsible manner. And with more than 2,000 workers on the slope this season, safety has never been more critical.
Thank you, Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. I appreciate the focus on safety and was curious if you analyze fatalities that do occur on the slope, including, say, from another operator, and then reference what happened afterward against your own practices to make sure that all companies are doing everything possible to avoid such a tragedy recurring.
Yeah, Representative Fields, through the chair, absolutely we do. So we had, you know, a very challenging year on the slope last year. I understand there were three fatalities. ConocoPhillips was not directly involved with any of those, but anytime something like that happens, anytime we have a life-altering event, it is something that we consider with respect to our own operations, and it's an opportunity for us to learn, to work with our contractors to learn, and to ensure that, you know, we're benefiting from the sometimes tragic experience of other companies so that we don't repeat the same mistakes. And, you know, when we have similar incidents, we do our best to share our learnings with our JV partners and with other operators on the slope so that we're continually cultivating a safer and safer environment. So absolutely, that's something that's important to us.
Thank you. And just in the interest of time, if we can move forward with the remaining two slides. And
sure.
Thank you.
Okay, so now I'll pivot a bit to talk about not just what we do, but how we do it. So in our operations, we are focused on sustainably meeting energy demand, but we're also committed to creating lasting value for the communities near our operations. And here in Alaska, we've been sustainably developing the state's oil and gas for as long as we've been here. It's important for the communities and the ecosystems in which we operate, and it's how we've been successful here in Alaska for more than 50 years. We believe in creating shared value for communities in Alaska, promoting economic growth, and being deliberate stewards of the environment in which we operate. And of course, we also know it's the right thing to do. And in all of this, ConocoPhillips is guided by our core values. We call them our spirit values, and it is these values which lead us to continue to invest in Alaskan communities because we know being a responsible neighbor is important. In 2024, we awarded $7.6 million in grants to over 250 different Alaska organizations. Our employees share this commitment and this responsibility, and we do have significant employee involvement across our outreach efforts. We understand the importance of giving back in the communities in which we operate, and we're dedicated to continuing this support. And this last slide I'll try to move through quickly, but just to quickly take a look at some of the numbers. So we had our earnings release call last week, and we announced that in 2024, ConocoPhillips Alaska generated $1.3 billion of earnings. But with those earnings, we had an associated $1.5 billion of taxes and royalties. And of that amount, $1.1 billion went to the state of Alaska. We invested $3.2 billion in capital in our Alaska operations, which was more than the $1.7 billion in 2023. And obviously, a lot of that growth was driven by Willow. Also, quickly, I wanted to provide a bit of context about how the company's Alaska operations fit into the overall ConocoPhillips portfolio. So, in 2024, Alaska represented about 10% of ConocoPhillips' total production, but it represented about 26% of our total capital investment. So, you know, we think that's a good indication of just how important our Alaska operations are to the global portfolio. We do have compelling asset opportunities across the company, especially in the lower 48, where efficiencies have driven down the cost of capital and the cost of doing business. But even in this strong portfolio, our Alaska assets are continuing to attract new capital in the current stable fiscal regime. And I'll say that our CEO started here. He understands the business very well, and Alaska continues to be a crown jewel in the ConocoPhillips portfolio.
Thank you so much.
And that's it.
And just with the interest of time, I just want to thank you, Mr. Romberg and Mr. Carlson, for your presentation. I will hold for any questions, but if any committee members do have any questions, please, we can ask by email and then share the answers with the committee. So with that, thank you so much, and we will take a brief at ease while we switch presenters. We're back on record. Next up, we'll hear from Peter LaLiberté from Santos. Mr. LaLiberté, please put yourself on record and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much. Fantastic pronunciation. Appreciate that. My name is Peter LaLiberté, for the record. I'm Vice President for Business Development for Santos here in Alaska. So thanks very much to the committee for having us here. I'm really proud to represent the company. I wanted to give you an idea of what we're doing on the slope and kind of start by, you know, customarily, you know, our business is all about getting access to land. And so we like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land before we start any kind of formal meetings. So Santos acknowledges that today we're meeting on the traditional land of the territory of the Akwang on Lingit Nanai, and we pay our respects to their history, experiences, and contributions in taking care of these lands. Santos also acknowledges the land our project is on as a traditional territory of the Inupiat and the Inupiat people of the North Slope, and we pay our respects to their history, experiences, and contributions in taking care of those lands. Land is very important to us, as you know. This is we have an impact on the land, and we believe it's important to pay respects to those that have been the traditional custodians of that land. So before we start, we're also a public company. We're listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. So as a normal disclaimer, you know, everything that I tell you today that's forward-looking, please don't rely on for any kind of investment decisions. So so what I wanted to tell you about a little bit is kind of how we got ourselves here and exactly what we're doing on the North Slope. Santos is an Australian company, as I've said. We're actually primarily an LNG supplier. So we supply LNG in Asia-Pacific region. In 2021, we merged with Oil Search. So originally, the positions here in Alaska were held by Oil Search, but there was a merger. Oil Search itself was also an Australian company. There was a merger in 2021. And in that, Alaska became part of the Santos portfolio. We've got about 4,000 employees globally. In Alaska, we own our core holdings, our core land holdings. We lease 51% as Santos, we operate. And then we have a partner who's quite critical in our operations as well, which is Repsol. So Repsol owned 49% of most of the holdings that we call kind of our core area. And I'll go through that in a little more detail as we get more into this. We have about 370 people right now. I was employee number 47 when I joined in 2018. I didn't really introduce myself, but I used to work for BP. I worked in BP for about 17 years. About half of that was on Alaska Gas, and then the other half was overseas for BP, working on major projects like this one. So I was really happy to get the opportunity to join Oil Search at the time, now Santos, to help develop the PICA project. And really, it was an exciting time, as a lot of my colleagues felt as well, to actually see this resurgence of investment on the North Slope and see this revitalization of the industry here. So speaking of revitalization, the other thing we're really proud about is our new downtown Anchorage office location. So if you haven't seen it, we'd welcome to give you a tour. Brooke, my colleague here, would be happy to give you the tour if you haven't already. We're really proud to be downtown and really enjoying it. And then PICA itself is, it's considered a giant oil field. So it was originally discovered by Repsol, and was the discovery itself was confirmed by Armstrong Oil and Gas, whom you will no doubt know well in Alaska. And it was confirmed as a giant oil field, which is actually quite significant. It was one of the biggest discoveries of the year in North America, confirmed in 2017. And as far as PICA itself, and our shareholders really place a lot of emphasis on responsible development, and that includes CO2 mitigation. So we actually have a focus on carbon mitigation, which is really driven by the expectations of our shareholders. And so that's something that is important to us, and something that we've incorporated into the PICA project as Santos. And then, of course, as I've said before, we impact local stakeholders. We impact the state of Alaska on the land holdings. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that we leave, we minimize the impact and provide sustainable support to the community when we do leave, ultimately, when the fields are over. So as far as how we got here, we started in 2018 operating on the slope. 80% of our employees were hired within Alaska, and really building this great team has been critical to our success here. I think it's a real testament to the strength of the Alaska workforce that we were able to build a company around Alaskan Hire. We also brought a lot of Alaskans back. A lot of people who had been overseas or been down to the lower 48 and saw what we were doing up here in Alaska and actually came back. So now 95% of our workforce live in Alaska, and we're continuing to grow that workforce as we progress our projects. When we started, the first thing that we needed to do was really kind of establish trying to let people know who we were and what we were all about, and really started by trying to develop some key relationships within the state. The first and kind of most important to me was developing a land use agreement with Kuukpik. This is the village, obviously, that is most impacted by the operations that we have on the North Slope. And so where we started really was trying to ensure that we set up a relationship with Kuukpik that really reinforced continuous consultation with the village as far as what we're doing. And so we signed a land use agreement with them. And really one of the things that was kind of unique about it is that it sets up a process where we're continuously talking about exactly what we're doing in nearly every aspect of what we're proposing to do on the North Slope. And that's been something that has created a very sustainable relationship with the people in the village. As well, we obviously needed to set up relationships with contractors. As you'll see in this diagram, there's that little donut down there. 68% of our spend in Alaska is through Alaskan vendors. And so it was obviously important to start, getting to know our contractors, also getting our contractors to understand kind of the expectations that we have in terms of efficiency and safety. And then finally, you know, we've obviously developed a relationship with those in the state that ultimately are responsible for the land. You know, we think this phase one development of PICA is going to provide about $7 billion in royalty and tax revenue to both the state and to local stakeholders. And so we're happy that, you know, this will impact all of Alaska. And then,
if I can ask, I just wanted to follow up to the slide before about the employees. So if you can provide a breakdown kind of what subcontractors, or I guess how many employees you have that are employed by subcontractors, and what the breakdown of them in Alaska is. And then, and you don't, if you don't have the information right now, you don't, it's fine. But in the future, if you could provide that to us so that it can be shared with the rest of the committee. And then you touched on very briefly how it impacts all of Alaska and in certain ways, but maybe you can break down with the 7i a little bit more on how that's impacted.
So the mineral rights for the PICA leases are owned in combination. They're owned by the state, and they're also owned by ASRC. So a lot of the royalties that we will be paying will be going to ASRC, and then that is going to be shared under 7i and then 7j with all of the Native Alaskan communities in the state.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Mr. La Liberté, I note that you're 80% employee hired from Alaska. I think that's a success story. And I just kind of guess I want to understand the attraction, and I have kind of a somewhat left-field question, but does your company offer employees a defined benefit pension or defined contribution or profit sharing or performance bonus, or how is it you're able to attract people to work, so many Alaskans to work for your company?
Sorry, Representative Sadler through the chair. The time that we hired was actually really an opportune time because there were a lot of people on the market at the time, frankly. There was a lot of transition that was going on in the oil fields. It was, you know, as we were really staffing up, there were both folks that were kind of, or there were some reorganizations that were happening with some of the majors on the slope. And so a lot of people just wanted to stay in Alaska, frankly. And so we got really lucky in terms of the timing at when we were first starting to put together the team. Now, obviously, we've had to attract people since then. We have, a standard corporate remuneration package, base salary, a 401k, and a bonus structure. We think that's a competitive package. And what we're doing is really also trying to make people kind of not make them, but we hope that people are bought into the excitement of what we're doing on the slope, right? We have a really tight team, and we've got a lot of people that really enjoy going to work every day, right? And I think that's where we start with trying to attract people here, and hopefully, you know, as we're attracting new people here, that kind of enthusiasm rubs off when they come up and see us and interview with us, because we do think we're doing something unique on the slope.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. La Liberté. Please proceed.
Thank you. So, as I said before, it's really important to our shareholders that not only are we acting safely and being good custodians of the funds of the company and generating a good return, but that also we can prove that we're helping to decarbonize our business. And this is one of these areas where a lot of what the legislature has done very recently is so well aligned with our corporate mission as well for decarbonization. So that goes to both nature-based offsets as well as carbon sequestration. So we've just recently started up a carbon sequestration project in one of the largest in the world now, the Moomba project in Australia. And that's something that we're trying to bring to Alaska. So we've formed a consortium where we're trying to looking at carbon sequestration projects in the state, and we've just recently received a DOE grant that will hopefully help us progress that. In addition, we're for PICA, we decided we announced at the time when PICA was announced to the market that we were going to be net zero. And so at that time, we really had to have a plan for buying offset credits. And our focus has always been buying offset credits in Alaska. So basically making sure that we are, you know, if we are buying offset credits, we're doing it in the place that we're impacting. So we've worked with a couple of Native Alaskan corporations to help us with offsets. So that's really been kind of the heart of what we're doing. At the core of what we're trying to do is have the least CO2 intensive project we can. And fortunately, PICA sits in that bucket already. It was designed in a way where we've basically electrified all the operations on the slope, and so all we're doing is using electricity to power our pumps, as opposed to natural gas. Now we do have to burn natural gas to generate that electricity. So that's kind of something that we've tried to minimize as we can, but. Those are kind of the elements that we've done to try to get a net zero project.
Thank you, Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. I just wanted to express appreciation to Santos for attempting to scale up carbon sequestration. I think when you look at the climate change-induced disasters around the world, it's pretty clear that we need to achieve very large-scale carbon sequestration in addition to decarbonizing electric assets. So just wanted to thank you all for my children's generation.
Thank you. Do you want to respond?
Representative Fields, through the chair. I mean, I guess I would just say, and thank you to the legislature for creating an environment where we can do that. So we feel appreciative as well that this is allowing us to kind of fulfill these kind of corporate goals of ours.
Thank you. Representative Mears?
Thank you. This is a good segue through the chair. So in addition to just a global outlook and a corporate philosophy on decarbonization, do you find that it also helps with getting investors for your projects?
Representative Mears, through the chair. It definitely allows us to continue to invest in Alaska as it relates to our own shareholders, right? So every time we're investing, there are choices to put the money that we generate from our existing business in Australia and in elsewhere there's a choice as to where that money goes, and we have to demonstrate these corporate goals to continue to get that funding. As far as other investors, I think it's very mixed. There are some that have a similar philosophy, and then there are some that don't have requirements or don't put requirements on themselves to have similar decarbonization goals. So it really depends on the investor.
Follow up, Representative Mears.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I think it's a larger thing that we're looking at is that we're not just providing like a regulatory environment for businesses to operate, but when we're looking at what allows you to have corporate policies that allow for more investment, that allows in more work here in Alaska. So it'll be coming up in other areas, I believe, but I think that's a real example that's part of the work that we can do here is, recognizing and corporate goals and investment opportunities is something we should keep an eye on.
Thank you, Representative Mears, and I'll ask that we hold further questions so we can get through the presentation. We've got about 20 minutes left.
20 minutes left, okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much. For the record, this is Pete Liliberté again. So that's kind of how we got to PICA and how we were able to sanction phase one of PICA. And just so that you're familiar with this, where we are in Alaska, I've got this lease map, so you can kind of see the light blue areas are where we hold leases in Alaska. As you can see where PICA is, and that whole area around PICA, we kind of call our core development area. That's where we're developing phase one. We have a phase two project that's permitted already where we would expand PICA phase one. And then basically we'd be moving on to the Quokka unit and over to the Horseshoe unit. And then a significant amount of acreage that's non-unitized in the south of our core area where we would going to continue to appraise. And this is really that core area, the presentation prior to me, you know, you saw the big hole in the lease positions of ConocoPhillips. We're really filling that hole right here with the lease positions that we have, and feel like we're in a really sweet spot for this particular type of reservoir. We're also looking at other reservoirs similar to this in the east. You know, this is one where, given the activity that we have in the core area, we were happy that we were able to bring in another major investor, APA Corporation, that came in. They farmed into the Lanyap area. That's about 270,000 acres out to the east, just south of Badami and Point Thompson. They're drilling an exploration well, not they, Armstrong Oil and Gas is drilling an exploration well as operator of that area right now, but with the support of this new entrant, or returnee, I guess, to Alaska. And then with Armstrong, we're 50-50 in kind of our western acreage in the NPRA, which we call Nanuship West. And you'll hear the term Nanuship referred to a lot. That's kind of what we call the reservoir, is the Nanuship Reservoir that we're developing. And the Nanuship Reservoir goes basically to the edge of Quokka all the way west throughout the NPRA. So that's our lease position. We've got about 490,000 acres in the core area, 270,000 acres in Lanyap, and almost 1 million acres in the NPRA. And the PICA project itself, this is kind of our footprint and where the various parts of the project are that we're developing. I'll start over to the west with the NDB. This is our drill site, basically. It's a single drill site where we're developing PICA Phase 1. Right next to it is the NPF, which is the processing facility. The N stands for Nanuship. So right next to it is the processing facility, NPF, and then our operations pad. The initial processing is going to be about 80,000 barrels a day of capacity, and we're doing this with a modular design. So the idea is that we're able to go up in increments of at least 40,000 barrels a day. PICA Phase 2, we hope, is just a doubling of capacity on the NPF. And then we come back to tie into existing infrastructure. So that tie-in pad is where our pipeline, our sales oil pipeline, will connect in to the Park Transportation Company pipeline that will then ultimately connect us into TAPS and allow us to bring our oil to Valdez. Up at the very top of that, this is in the Kaparik River unit, right on the edge of it on the tidewater, is a seawater treatment plant. And what we do with that seawater is basically to treat it to be able to reinject it in the reservoir. So for every barrel of oil we take out, we want to at least put in one barrel of water to replace it to maintain the pressure in the reservoir. And so we have to have a source of water to do that, treated water to do that. And so we're building a new seawater treatment plant at Aleutuk Point, right next to the Nikayachuk and the ConocoPhillips seawater treatment plant on Aleutuk Point. So those are kind of the components and the impact or the footprint for our project. I should also say that we have about 120 miles of pipeline that is being built in between all these facilities. And to give you a sense of kind of where we've gone, I should pause for questions. But once we go back, I just wanted to give you a bit of a quick video just to show you exactly kind of the progress that we're making on the slope.
Are there any quick questions from the committee? Hearing none.
Should be good. So if you bear with me, what we wanted to show you is just exactly the progress that we're making, and hopefully kind of give you a sense of what we're, you know, the activity and the enthusiasm that we've got going on with this project. So here's our this is our construction. Short and sweet. But, you know, I think what it really does, as do these pictures, it really shows kind of the progress that's been made, right? So a year on, from summer 2023 to summer 2024, you can kind of see this is our drill site. In summer 23, we just had the rig on site, and we're just starting to rig up. And as you can see now, we're in full drilling mode. We've got pipelines installed. We've got our grind and deject facility built where we're going to put all the cuttings from our wells. And we've got a very, very active drill site going on there. To give you kind of the highlights of where we're at, you know, we're going to be investing $3.2 billion. That's us and our partner Repsol. Peak production, as I said before, is 80,000. We're planning for first oil in the first half of 2006, but we have an opportunity to accelerate that. And what we're really targeting is trying to complete our pipelines, which is really the critical path item in our project. We're trying to complete our pipelines by the end of this winter, so that we have the opportunity to go ahead and start up by the end of the year. And that's something that we're all working on. To do that, we've got 2,200 contractors working on the slope in 24/7 operations, trying to get there. We're 74% of the way done. This is 15 wells that have been drilled since December. I think we're on 17 right now. So, I mean, drilling continues to make great progress, and we're kind of well on our way to first oil.
Thank you. I've got Representative Rauscher, then Representative Representative Coulomb.
Thank you, through the chair. It says here on page 9, single drill pad, and for 45 total wells. But I remember when I was flying over there, when we were coming back in and out, it seemed like there were a lot more drill sites than just one. Am I mistaken?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, there's only one drill site that we're developing in this phase. There will be two other drill sites that are permitted that will ultimately consist of phase two. One's in the north, one's to the south of that. The other pads that you probably saw were where we put our production facility and then where we're putting our operations facility. So basically our camps and our staff in that operations pad. So there are additional pads that were constructed, but there's only one where we actually will have the wells.
I think
at this stage.
I thought they were.
Yes.
I thought those were exploration wells that I was looking at.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, they may have been. I'm not sure when you went over, but we are still appraising.
Before I became a legislator, I guess about 2-3 years. Working on Repsol.
So Representative Rauscher, through the chair, yes, we definitely are continuing to appraise different areas in that lease acreage that I showed you earlier. We have drilled one well in the Horseshoe unit that was called Stirrup, and then there was one in Quokka called Mitcook. So those may be those ones that you've seen.
That's possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher, Representative Coulomb. And just to note, we have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Burke. Through the chair, so I'm wondering, this lack of agreement between you and Conoco on the road use, how's that affecting the rest of Phase 1, Phase 2? Is it slowing things down at this point?
Representative Coulomb, through the chair, so all our business is risk-based. And so what we have to do as we kind of appraise any kind of investment decision or any kind of progress is to assess all the risks. I think, you know, the fact that we're hopefully going to be closer to an agreement with ConocoPhillips is something that will ultimately reduce risk for any kind of further development. But certainly getting access to the leases is kind of fundamental and is certainly a big risk.
I have a follow-up.
Representative Club.
So through the chair, so I guess what I'm getting at is that it's going to be additional money to Santos, so I didn't know if that was affecting your movement forward from here on.
Representative Coulomb, through the chair, so are you saying the actual payments that are expected?
Yeah, through the chair. So It sounds like you're going to be paying Conoco money that you didn't originally expect to have to pay. And so is that going to affect what you're doing, what phase one, phase two looks like?
Representative Colomb, through the chair. So, you know, there are this is an unexpected payment that we would be making. And all of that affects the overall economics that, you know, the economic objectives that we're trying to meet for our shareholders. That's one aspect of other things as well. I mean, we've actually had a cost overrun on the project as well. So there are a number of risks that, you know, end up materializing, and they do affect investment decisions as we move forward.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Colomb, and recognizing Representative Fields that you raise your hand. Is this regarding the road, or is this? Okay, can we hold the road questions until we have DNR and law? Okay, thank you. Seeing no further questions, recognizing the time that we have, Mr. La Liberté, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. You know, this is kind of the biggest thing we want to leave you with is that, as you saw in that land position, there's a lot more to go here. We see pick a phase one will develop about 400 million barrels. And we see within PICA kind of a, almost, you know, 900 million to a billion barrel opportunity. You're going to see we've got some reserve numbers in here that are part of our corporate reporting, but what that really represents is what we know, not what we expect. And what we're trying to do is replicate PICAs in Quokka and Horseshoe. What we're trying to do is de-risk those areas in the same way to make sure that we have kind of the scale that we have in PICA to continue to develop. And you can kind of see from the profile here what that means for Alaska. PICA Phase 1, you know, that's kind of the 80,000-barrel-a-day project that we're talking about, and we've got these multiple phases in front of us. You know, Representative Colomb, as you kind of pointed out, you know, the risk factors that we have will play into all of those future investment decisions. But what I would say is that, you know, the environment in Alaska has been really positive for our company. The fact that Alaska actually wants development is an extremely rare thing, actually, believe it or not, in jurisdictions. You'd think that resource owners would want their resources developed, but in a responsible way. But what we're finding is that Alaska is, you know, has created a fairly a welcoming environment for future investment. And we do hope that that continues because, you know, as we said, we think the scale of this, you know, is quite significant.
Representative Sadler.
I can't help it. Madam Chair, I appreciate your turns there because part of what has made Alaska more inviting was passage of SB 21, which has been largely denigrated. And I think the importance of having a stable tax philosophy in Alaska and not punitive taxes is what has invited PICA to the table, what has gotten Santos to invest, and part of what makes this a welcoming state. And the revenue we hope to spend in various ways is going to come through the incentives and the investments just like we're seeing here. So I appreciate you being in Alaska.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
And so just to close this out, you know, we're really trying to build a business here. This isn't just about PICA Phase 1 or PICA itself, right? What we're really trying to do is build a scale, a large-scale business in Alaska, and we hope to continue to be able to do that and look forward to working in the state for many years to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? We've got a few more minutes. Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. I know that Santos has achieved a pretty admirable rate of Alaska hire, but just as you're working on recruiting employees from outside to stay in Alaska or working to retain employees, I would appreciate just being kept up to date about what you're hearing from those employees, things that are beyond your control, housing, schools, public safety, so that I can be responsive and we can be responsive to those. Thank you.
Representative Fields, through the chair, if I may. So, you know, we have – obviously we try to bring people into the state as much as we can. Unfortunately, we don't always get good data as to why they don't take a job. And that's been one of the kind of the challenges that we have. I don't know how we kind of turn that around or get that, but that's one of the challenges that we've had as far as, you know, if people deny offers. Sometimes maybe it's for the money, but sometimes maybe it's for other things. We certainly have people interested, and I think what you're finding is that there is definitely more and more interest just in general in the lower 48, in Alaska, in terms of this basin and what's happening in the Nanushuk reservoirs. I mean, it really is an exciting opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Klum?
Yeah, Chair, just a comment. I thank you for letting us ask about the road. I understand there's another meeting coming, but that's with the department. It was important for me to hear from the companies, their perspective. It has potentially big impacts on development in North Slope, so just wanted to thank you for giving us some flexibility to get some answers there.
Thank you, Representative Klum. Are there any other questions for Mr. La Liberté? Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair, I'm curious, are there certain recruitment tactics that Santos tries to leverage when it comes to hiring folks, whether Alaskans or from outside, when it comes to trying to encourage someone to come up here? And if I could just share an anecdote that I learned over the fall last year, where one of Alaska's largest private businesses had to change their recruitment tactics for hiring people because of certain challenges that our state is facing right now. And so they had to pivot the type of folks that they were recruiting to come here, that they wanted to work here, as a result of those challenges. So I'm just kind of curious, like, you probably don't have this information available to you right now, but if you could maybe find out, like, is Santos targeting families? Are you targeting people who don't have children? Like, does your recruitment go to that depth or level, I guess, is my question.
Representative Hall, through the Chair. In the first instance, we're trying to find the right person to fill the job. Obviously, that would be the case. And as far as finding kind of, tactics as far as attracting people, I could certainly give you, we could find some more information. We have recruiters. We actually have a recruiter that's based in Houston who, can give face-to-face engagements with folks that we are trying to recruit to come to Alaska, as well as a recruiter here. We have a little bit of a different position because we're not. This is our North American operation, right? We don't have the ability to just kind of pull people from other assets in North America to come here as part of their normal career progression. So it is a little different, and we can certainly try to give you a sense of kind of the tactics that are being used to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we are at time. So I want to thank you, Mr. La Liberté, for your presentation today. We will take another quick brief at ease while we switch presenters. We are back on record, and finally today we'll hear from Jill Fisk from Hillcorp. Ms. Fisk, please put yourself on record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Burke, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to give an update on our North Slope operations. My name is Jill Fisk. My current position is Senior Asset Team Leader for the Milne Point Unit Asset at Hillcorp. I was previously one of the asset team leaders for the Prudhoe Bay Unit for Hillcorp. I'm very proud to be here today representing more than 1,700 Hillcorp Alaska employees to provide you an update, a little bit of an overview on our assets and an update on our 2025 activity. I do have quite a few slides. Some of them I'll move through quickly, but feel free to stop and ask questions as we go. For way of an agenda, my first few slides are a general overview of Hillcorp, and then I will go into specific slides on each of our North Slope assets. To start off, a little overview of Hilcorp and our strategy. We do, our kind of target goal of Hilcorp is we are the best operator of late life assets in the industry. We're very proud of taking assets that are later in their life, reinvigorating those assets, and getting more value out of those assets. That kind of starts with the diagram on the slide to the left, kind of starting at the top with those opportunistic acquisitions. As we bring those assets into Hilcorp, we improve operating efficiency, develop the properties, maintain strong cash flow to extend the life of those assets and increase recovery of the oil, oil and gas. And then we are proud that we are responsible operators of those assets, that when they do finally reach the end of their life, we're responsible for retiring those end-of-life assets and then starting that cycle again. On the right are our mission, vision, and core values of the company. I won't go into these individually, but as I move through the updates on our assets and our plans for 2025, you will definitely see these values in action in the way we operate and invest in these assets. A little background on Hilcorp's history in Alaska. We entered Alaska in 2012 with our initial acquisitions in Cook Inlet and Kenai areas from Chevron and Marathon, and then entered the North Slope in 2014 with our initial acquisition from BPXA. We continued with acquisitions kind of big and small as we continued to grow those operating areas, with our latest acquisition being in November 2024 with the E&I assets on the North Slope. One thing I'd like to point out here is that most of the companies that we've acquired these assets for have exited Alaska and are no longer here. Hilcorp is very proud to be part of Alaska and to be investing and growing in Alaska. And we take that job seriously as the operator of these assets, again, to reinvigorate and extend the life of these assets so that they continue to add value to the people of Alaska. Overall stats for Hilcorp in Alaska, we are the largest operator and the largest gas supplier in Alaska. This is based on our operated oil and gas production rates from our fields. We have about 1,700 employees in Alaska, over 2,500 contractors, which that number can vary depending on the projects going on, but about 2,500 contractors at any given time, over 2,000 producing wells, and we have gross operated production of about 350,000 barrels of oil per day and 165 million cubic feet of gas per day. We're also very proud of our more than 700 partnerships with local businesses generating over 750 million in annual spend with our Alaska vendors.
Thank you. Just a question kind of to align with the others. If you can provide us with a breakdown of what the Alaska Hire is.
Sure. Of our 1,700 employees, I don't have the exact percentage. I know it is more than 70%. I can get the exact percentage for you. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
I don't have that exact number, but it is over 70%. I will say it is our goal to hire Alaskan hires as much as possible. To that end, one of the things that we are very proud of doing is our partnerships with both local high schools and universities and trade schools in the state of Alaska, trying to grow that pipeline of Alaska hires to be available for us to hire as we need to recruit new positions.
Thank you. Representative Fields?
Thank you. Through the chair, just following up on that, does your company put in Alaska Hire incentives for contractors or requirements for certain percentages? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, no, we leave it up to our contractors to determine the best people to hire for their position, so we don't have particular incentives in place for them.
Thank you.
All right, quick map showing an overview of our North Slope operations. This map labels the major fields across the North Slope, with the red stars indicating the fields operated by Hilcorp. Starting in the east with Point Thompson and moving across to our newest assets in the western North Slope area. As I walk through the next slides, I will start at the east and move our way west through each of these fields. One more overview of just our overall strategy as we acquire these assets. Often when we acquire an asset, it is later in its life. The asset has generally been declining for quite a few years, likely with minimal investment for numerous years. So our first goal when we acquire an asset is to arrest that production decline, to stabilize and maybe even start growing production in the field so that we can stabilize cash flow and start with our investment. Part of doing that is also controlling operating costs in the field to make the field more cost efficient. Then we can turn our attention to investing in and repairing and maintaining the infrastructure in the field. This is where we're looking at doing the most with what we already have in place in that field, getting the best capacity out of those facilities. And then finally, as we evaluate the fields, study the long-term and remaining potential of the field, we are investing for the long run. We start investing in both capital and the repair side of extending the life of that asset and improving the value. On our investing in Alaska in 2025, the graphic at the top of this slide shows our drilling program for the North Slope for 2025 across our assets. When we talk about investing for the long run and growing, you can see that is definitely dominated by the Milne Point unit and Prudhoe Bay unit, which dominates this drilling schedule. We currently have five drilling rigs running on the North Slope, which will be working across Milne Point and Prudhoe Bay for the full year. We also recently reactivated the Doyon 15 rig at Nikaichuk. It's currently doing workovers at that field. Before the winter's over, we will use an ice road to mob that rig to Dead Horse, where it will be staged to then move to Point Thompson next winter to start to drill one well at Point Thompson, which I'll talk about more in the Point Thompson slides. In 2024, Hilcorp invested about $870 million into our oil and gas properties in Alaska. And we produced 39 million barrels of oil on the North Slope, which was a 2% increase compared to 2023. When we look forward to 2025, we'll invest over $900 million on energy projects and expect forecasted production of 41 million barrels on the North Slope, which would be another 5% increase compared to last year. So we are continuing to grow and forecast that to continue on the North Slope. Now we'll move into our individual assets to give you an overview and a preview of 2025 activity. The first three are operated by our asset team that we call the Alaska Islands team. They have Point Thompson, Endicott, and North Star. We'll start with Point Thompson in the east side. This field first started producing in 2016. It's made 18 million barrels to date, which is only about 6% of the original oil in place so far. The asset currently produces 4,300 barrels of oil per day and 70 million cubic feet of gas. That production of 4,300 barrels comes from just one producing well at Point Thompson. There's one producing well and two injection wells. Our current goal, primary goal for 2025, is to maintain stable production from that one well. We have stabilized it over the last few months. But we are most excited about also preparing for a drilling program in 2026, which will be to drill one additional production well. That one well should more than double the production of Point Thompson, which would then fill the current facility to full capacity again. The schedule is our kind of target schedule that we have right now. As I mentioned, we would have the rig staged in Dead Horse to then mob via ice road in first quarter 2026 and drill that one well. Likely the rig will stay there through the summer and then do the completion work in the third quarter to eventually be demobed back to Dead Horse by barge. As we move on to Endicott, as we keep moving west, first oil at Endicott was in 1986. This was the first artificial Arctic island under production connected via causeway to the mainland. Cumulative production there is about 500 million barrels, which is about 55% of the oil in place. Current production is 5,600 barrels of oil per day, 450 million cubic feet of gas, and 270,000 barrels of water per day. Looking at Endicott activity for 2025, We plan to increase recovery by improving our field-wide production and injection conformance. The map on this slide is our K2A reservoir. The area shaded in red is the part of the reservoir that's currently full of gas, which we don't want to produce. The area in green is the area of the reservoir filled with oil, which is where we want to improve recovery and get as much out as possible. We will do this by moving our production and injection wells further down dip. We can do this via workovers on those wells in order to continue to improve recovery as that oil rim moves down. We're also evaluating future coil tubing and rotary drilling potential at Endicott, as well as an interesting pilot that the team has planned for this year of trying injection with water alternating gas. Instead of just gas or just water, this is a way to help improve recovery from that remaining oil rim. And then finally on this team is the North Star field. As we continue to move west, the first oil at North Star was in 2002. Cumulative production is 193 million barrels, which is a little over 60% of the original oil in place has been recovered. Current production at North Star is 5,500 barrels of oil per day, 600 million cubic feet of gas, and 15,000 barrels of water. North Star activity for 2025, a little similar idea to Endicott. We're going to optimize perforation depths for the current oil column. So again, this is a map of one of the primary reservoirs. This reservoir was initially completely oil filled, so that map would have been all green. All the red now shows where the reservoir is gas-filled. So again, what we don't want to produce, the green is the remaining oil in this reservoir, which is what we're targeting to continue to improve our production there. So we will optimize the injection in these reservoirs to recover as much of that oil as possible. This team has an exciting new project starting with injecting their produced water into the Kuparuk formation. This is still pending BSEE approval, but they plan to start that as soon as they get full approval. This will help with maintaining the reservoir pressure in that reservoir, which again helps you recover more oil if you can keep more of the reservoir from becoming gas filled. And finally, they also plan to test the SAG reservoir, which is not currently a producing reservoir at North Star, but is possible potential. So we're going to test the commercial viability of that reservoir this year. This team is also evaluating some possible future drilling opportunities for North Star. That is the last slide for the islands team. Any questions on those?
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. Briefly, Ms. Fisk, the gas produced at North Star and Indica, is that reinjected? I know it's not produced. What happens to the gas?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, we reinject that gas. So this gas is processed on the surface to remove as much of the liquids as possible that are entrained in the gas. That becomes part of our sales. And then that gas is reinjected into the reservoir with the goal of trying to maintain reservoir pressure as much as possible.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Hearing none, Ms. Fisk.
Right, now we will move on to Prudhoe Bay as we continue the journey west across the North Slope. So Prudhoe Bay's first oil was in 1977. Prudhoe has about 25 billion barrels of oil in place. We've produced a little bit over half of that to date at 13 billion barrels. Prudhoe also has about 40 TCF of original gas in place, much of which is still in the reservoir. We have, working just the Prudhoe Bay asset, we have about 830 Hillcorp employees and over 1,500 contractors in the field. Current rates at Prudhoe Bay, although they do vary seasonally, but right now the Prudhoe asset is at 265,000 barrels of oil per day. We move about 8 to 9 BCF of gas per day in the Prudhoe asset. Again, that is also reinjected, processed, removed liquids, and reinjected into the reservoir. Prudhoe also moves about 2.2 million barrels of water per day, also reinjected into the reservoir or sometimes into disposal wells. The map on the right just shows you the scale of Prudhoe. The Prudhoe lease is 150,000 square miles or 234 acres. And just put it into perspective, that roughly stretches from Anchorage to Girdwood if we were to lay out the Prudhoe field in that area. couple slides, just overview and background on Prudhoe Bay. This is a zoomed-in map of Prudhoe showing a little more detail. Prudhoe Bay consists of 47 active pads and drill sites and a little over 1,000 online producing and injecting wells on any given day. There's about 230 miles of roads and almost 1,000 miles of pipelines in order to gather this production and get it to the TAPS pipeline. I will draw your attention to the far western end of this map on the left-hand side of the slide. The blue spots that you see within the lease are the Prudhoe drill sites or well pads. The four furthest west are we'll reference in a future slide as we zoom in on that western area of the field that is less developed than the proper than the main part of the field. Just some fun facts. I won't go through all of these in the sake of time, but I will touch again on that gas production. Currently in the winter, we are moving 8 to 9 BCF a day. In the summer, that dips down to about 6 BCF a day. That is enough to supply the entire country of Germany for their daily gas needs. And it's gas that Prudhoe is having to move in a circle every day. We do extract a lot of liquids from that gas that is our fuel gas, but most of it is then being reinjected into the reservoir. So we'll touch on that as I talk about some of our growth that we've had at Prudhoe Bay. A quick overview of the Prudhoe facilities, again, to draw the attention to where our constraints are in the field. On the left hand of the slide, production starts at our well pads with our wells on our well pads and drill sites. That production then moves into what we call flow stations and gathering centers, which are essentially facilities that are just separating oil, gas, and water. From those facilities, the oil makes its way to pump station one for sales. The water is reinjected into the reservoir or disposal wells. And then the most important part of this process is all of that gas, which then moves to our central gas facility and compression plants, number two and number three in this picture. That's important to highlight because that's that 8 to 9 BCF that we're of gas that we're moving. That is the constraint at Prudhoe. Prudhoe started its life as an oil field, but now it is very much a large gas field where we happen to also produce some oil along with that gas. So the oil is our constraint. The gas is our constraint. The more gas that we can move through these central gas facilities, the more oil that we're able to make. So that has been one of our major focus areas for increasing the production capacity of Prudhoe Bay. As I mentioned, when we first step in to a new acquisition, it is generally on the decline with lower investment levels over the last years. And it is our first goal to arrest that production decline, stabilize production and cash flow from the field so that we have the opportunity to make investments for growth. This plot shows Prudhoe's production history back to 2010. So you can see from 2010 to 2020, the field was on a pretty steady decline over that decade. The black dashed line at the bottom of the green wedge represents DOR's fall 2019 forecast for Prudhoe Bay. So the assumption then was that it would continue on that decline, which was a pretty realistic assumption to make based on that data. Hilcorp took over the field in mid-2020. You see the black line represents the actual production delivered in our first few years, where we were able to not only stabilize production, but also increase and grow that production somewhat at Prudhoe Bay. And keep in mind, the important thing there is those first 15 months of operating Prudhoe Bay, we did not have any drilling rigs running. That was during COVID when we stepped in, when activity levels were very low and prices were very low. So that growth in that first year and a half was from very creative ideas from all of our operators and really the work on the front lines from our employees and our contractors. That was not through a drill bit of adding new wells. What you can see now is the DOR's more recent spring 2024 forecast based on that recent production history of a more stabilized production forecast for Prudhoe Bay. And the green part in the middle are all the barrels that have been produced or will be produced in the future that maybe otherwise wouldn't have been. We like to call that the Hilcorp wedge or the Hilcorp effect on Prudhoe Bay. In talking about all those hundreds of ideas across the field, I'm not going to read through this slide, but it's just meant to show an example. A lot of these ideas were executed during the first year to year and a half of operating the field. We like to call it diamonds in the dirt because there were a lot of opportunities to improve operating efficiency, reduce cost, and increase rate across the field. A lot of these were very low-cost projects. Again, these were being executed in a time of low oil price. And limited drilling activity. And this is really our kind of motto at Prudhoe Bay is there at the bottom of the slide, everybody makes a difference. This is hundreds or over, in the case of Prudhoe, over 1,000 employees and contractors finding creative ways every day to increase the value and the rate at Prudhoe Bay. This slide is just meant to show an example of one of those very creative ideas. So our gas plants, where we're processing that 8 to 9 BCF a day, we're extracting natural gas liquids from that gas. Those NGLs are then blended into the oil and sold down the TAPS pipeline. The colder those NGLs are, the more that we can blend into the oil and therefore increase rate and increase sales. So one of our operators had the great idea of, well, if we want them to be cold, why are we insulating the lines that they flow through? Why not let Mother Nature help us keep them cold and therefore blend more oil? We did the proper engineering evaluations of that idea, made some tweaks to it, but it turned out to be a very good idea for very little money involved with that. And that added an additional 1,100 barrels of oil per day of production that continues from now on. That's not a declining, like a well that would be declining. So it's great creativity by our field. And that's, again, referencing back to our core values. That's giving the ownership and innovation from our existing employees. As we move on through Prudhoe Bay, Prudhoe Bay's history, we talked about arresting production decline, getting cost under control, stabilizing cash flow. Then we start looking to growth. And here's where I will reference back to the west end of the field that I pointed out on the map. Building off of the success that we had already had at Milne in developing the Schrader Bluff Reservoir. So this is the viscous oil that was being referenced earlier, that it's tougher oil to produce and separate and get sold. There was very little focus on this oil to this point at Prudhoe Bay because there were much bigger reservoirs to develop. You can see when Hilcorp took over in 2020, the green line is the production history of just the viscous oil in the Schrader Bluff at Prudhoe. In 2020, they were making about 10,000 barrels a day of production from the Schrader Bluff. As we ramped up our drilling activity at Prudhoe, our initial focus was pretty much solely on the Schrader Bluff development, and we have ramped up production to over 30,000 barrels of oil per day, with more opportunity to come. A lot of this development is happening in the western side of the field in those four western pads. That is where the potential sits as you move closer to Milne and where it's the least developed area of the field. So we will continue to have focus on developing the Schrader Bluff. Part of developing Schrader is not just drilling those wells, but being able to process that oil when it comes to surface. It is viscous, kind of heavier, more tar-like oil that is much harder to separate and get clean, get the water and gas separated from it in order to sell it. On the western end, this is the western end of Prudhoe Bay. You see the L, V, Z, and W pads are where this development occurs. But all of that production flows back through what we call our EWE pipeline back to the GC2 facility. So we've completed numerous projects within GC2 to upgrade equipment to be able to handle this viscous oil. But our current largest project is what we call the EWE, or our West End pipeline. We are building a new 30-inch production pipeline and 12-inch gas lift line, which is currently under construction. This is going to add West End production capacity, allow more to be produced from those pads, as well as allow production from future new pads that would be built at the west end of Prudhoe Bay. Construction is expected to be complete in mid-March, with the pipelines coming on in mid-year.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Chris, through the Chair, I'll ask you the same question I asked of Conoco. What is it that has allowed you to increase your production of this heavy oil?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, At Prudhoe Bay in particular, it's been facility modifications and just a drilling program that is focused on that oil. We do have slightly better oil properties. It's less viscous in Prudhoe than it is in Milne Point or in Kuparuk. So we do get the benefit of having a little bit better, still viscous oil, but a little bit easier to produce. We also at Prudhoe have what we call miscible injectant available to us. MI is made from our gas plant, processed from our gas, and that has helped increase the recovery from our enhanced oil recovery projects. We have found a lot of value in injecting that MI into the Schrader Bluff through injectors to allow more oil to move to our producers.
If I could probe that just a little bit through the chair. Facility modification is a fairly general term. I'm not looking for trade secrets, but just how would you modify? Because the production of heavy oil, I think, is an important part of Bruta's future. So.
Yes, it is. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. The boxes in green on this slide on the right side, the main box in green, the upper right, is our main focus at GC2. And that has been a revamp of, there's three processing trains that run through GC2 where we separate oil, gas, and water. Two of those we have upgraded, two big upgrades that we made. One was changing the design of the internals of the slug catcher. The slug catcher is the first vessel that the oil, gas, and water come into when they're coming from these big 30-inch pipelines. We through a full shutdown of that train, we opened up those vessels, basically removed the internals that were in there, and put in redesigned internals that allowed better separation of the viscous oil. Those facilities were all originally designed to produce very light oil from the Ivishak Reservoir, so it's very different when you're producing the viscous oil. We also added sand jetting to all the vessels in that separation train. One of the downsides of producing the Schrader Bluff is it produces a lot of very flowery type sand with it that will make its way through the pipelines and into those vessels. It a lot of times will settle out in the bottom of those vessels. So to keep them operating as they're designed to do, we basically are jetting water through there to push that sand out. Water goes in and pushes the sand out to keep the vessel clean even while it's in use. Without that, you would have to shut the facility down more often to open the vessels up to clean them out.
Smart engineers. Thank you.
Thank you. And just, again, to be mindful of time, we've got about 12 minutes left.
Oh, great. Well,
if we can hold any questions from the committee, and then if we have some time, ask them. If not, we can email them and then respond. Get responses.
And I will get to Milne Point, which addresses more of the polymer injection.
Thank you.
Very quickly, our other focus, as I mentioned, has been on expanding capacity at our gas plants. As opposed to adding additional compression, we have focused on improving the efficiency of the compressors that we have already. This is a multi-year project where we're investing in the upgrades of both the high-stage and low-stage compressors to add gas processing capacity through these plants. That has allowed us to deliver very strong gas plant performance. This plot shows the volume of field gas each day on the y-axis versus the daily average temperature on the x-axis. What I'll point out is the black curve is the 2004 performance of the gas plants, which was assumed to have been the best ever performance. The red diamonds are what Hillcorp has been able to deliver as record days of moving gas through the gas plants, which have come as we've continued these upgrades on adding capacity. So excited to be delivering record performance through the gas plants, which again allows us to grow oil production. Okay, quick summary of Prudhoe Bay's 2025 focus areas. It's completing the pipeline project on the west end. That I pointed out, our 30-inch production pipeline. The team plans to drill about 58 wells across Prudhoe, both coil tubing drilling and rotary. We are looking at our different options for developing the west end of Prudhoe to continue to develop new areas of the Schrader Bluff. So our goal is to sanction a development plan for the west end this year. We're also executing a very high level of maintenance activity across the field. And continuing, even though we have a lot of exciting potential in the Schrader, continuing to evaluate and test potential of less developed reservoirs across Prudhoe. All right, and finally, moving on to Milne Point, next to last asset. I'll just touch here on the rates at the bottom. We're currently producing 50,000 barrels of oil per day, 36 million cubic feet of gas, which does get reinjected, and 250,000 barrels of water per day, which also gets either reinjected or injected into disposal wells. Working Milne Point, we have about 110 Hillcorp employees and over 400 contractors there at a time. This is the full production history of Milne Point. So again, here I'm just pointing out our ability to arrest production decline and then start growing the field. The field peaked in the late 90s at just under 60,000 barrels per day, but then went on a pretty steep decline for the decades following that peak. Hillcorp took over in late 2014. When the field was producing about 17,000 barrels per day. We spent a couple of years evaluating the potential, deciding how to move forward. But then as we started investing and growing, we've been very successful at that. And I'll just zoom into that on the next slide. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary at Milne Point. So like we like to highlight as a decade of dedication. The gray wedge at the bottom of this is the production that you would have seen from Milne Point had we just continued to produce what was already there. The green wedge is what the production we've delivered from our drilling program and our surface investments that we've made at Milne Point, recently setting a record on January 1st of over 51,000 barrels per day, a Hillcorp record. So how have we done that? How have we grown? And most of that growth has come from the Schrader Bluff, from the viscous oil. We've drilled 161 new wells during those 10 years. Again, as it was explained earlier, these are all horizontal wells where we're drilling down and then drilling out 8 to 12,000 feet within the Schrader Bluff. That all adds up to about 430 miles drilled in the Schrader Bluff with those wells. Those wells have produced 110 million barrels of oil with a lot more opportunity to continue to grow. These two maps, I'm not going to get into the details, but it's a great snapshot of what has happened at Milne and what can come in our other fields in the future. The map on the left is the Schrader Bluff as of 2014 when we took over. All the little dots are vertical wells. You see a few pink lines, so there was some horizontal drilling, but kind of scattered around the field. The map on the right is our current map of the Schrader Bluff. You can see a much heavier concentration. All the pink lines are those horizontal wells that we've been drilling. So really filling in the green space. All the green is where the oil is. But still with a lot of open green space to go, which is the focus of our drilling program. This is a slide to address how we've improved Schrader production and why we have focused on it at Milne and are excited about it in our other fields. And that was the implementation of the first ever polymer flood on the North Slope. We started with two pilot skids in 2018. We're now up to 10 active polymer injection skids injecting 60,000 barrels of water per day or polymer per day. With the growth that we have planned, we expect to take that up to around 160,000 barrels per day over the next few years. We're currently the eighth largest polymer flood in the world, and obviously the only one on the North Slope at this point. So we've seen a lot of success. Polymer essentially helps slow down water breakthrough. The top left slide shows the oil rate in green for this particular pad and the water rate in blue. Normally, water would break through very early because water and this viscous oil have very different viscosities. So the water would tend to finger past all the oil and make it to the injector very quickly, which then means you don't recover much of the oil in place. Typical water flood, you might recover 8 to 10% of the oil in place. When you add polymer instead, that makes the water thicker, more similar to the oil, lets it move more uniformly through the reservoir. Slow it down, and you see in this particular example, we had 5 years that we were able to inject with no breakthrough at the producers. So a very successful initial pilot in that reservoir, which lets you, with the polymer flood, our estimated recoveries are 30 to 35% of the oil in place. Also, as we continue to invest for the long run at Milne, same as I mentioned at Prudhoe, it's not just about drilling wells. We have to invest in the surface facilities as well. This is a list of the types of projects that we've invested in at Milne, anywhere from building brand new pads and facilities to expanding and upgrading the facilities that were already in place as we continue to grow and allow the additional drilling at Milne Point. Our 2025 activity is to we will complete pad and facility expansion projects on four of our pads at Milne. That work was already underway as we entered the year. We'll continue our power generation expansion and power reliability projects. So all these new pads require power to operate them. We're going to begin facility expansion on S-Pad for target completion in 2026. Our drilling program involves drilling about 22 Schrader Bluff wells, both producers and injectors, and one Ugnew producer, which is a shallower reservoir. And then we'll continue to evaluate additional pad and facility expansion projects.
Oh, sorry.
That's right.
Representative, yeah, we have 3 minutes left.
Oh, boy. Well,
is your question?
Real quick through the chair. Does Hillcorp own its own rigs or lease them out or a combination? A lot of drilling I'm hearing about.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we do own the Innovation rig that's currently working at Prudhoe Bay. The other rigs are leased from the companies that own those rigs.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. There was an unusual number of fatalities in the last year or so on the slope, and I think most, if not all, were contractors for Hillcorp. So my question was, has Hillcorp looked at its contracting protocols and identified what it can do in the future to make sure that such fatalities are less likely to occur, especially within your contracted workforce? Because looking across the country, there's a lot of data that as you have a more fissured workplace, contractors, subcontractors, there's unfortunately a correspondence to serious injury, death, and I would just appreciate your follow-up and how we can avoid such fatalities in the future. Thank you.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Fields. Yes, thank you for the question. Yes, as we have had strong performance in reducing incident rates among our employees, we have unfortunately had several tragic incidents among our contractors over the last year or two. First and foremost, safety is our top priority. We have to find a way to work safely and complete these projects safely, and that is our top focus. We are focused on increasing the safety culture across our fields. That is a must-do. We have to get better, and we have learned from those incidents. We are focusing with our contractor community on how to assure that better training is provided as they bring more and more workforce into Alaska. And we're working with them to develop those programs and assure for not only Hillcorp but across our industry on the North Slope that we have a trained and capable workforce and that we're putting the proper focus on the safety of that workforce.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Fields?
Well, it doesn't have to be now, but I would be curious about what Hillcorp learned from each of those incidents and kind of specifically how that is being addressed in similar contracts in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. And then in wrap-up, we do have another committee that's going to be meeting in here in the next 15 minutes. So if we can get through as fast as we can. Thank you.
I will do it quick so I can do a quick overview here. This is the Schrader Bluff regional view as we extend up into Nakayachuk. These are our two newest assets into the company just coming in November. So we'll jump forward to what we're excited about. There's a couple of background slides there, but looking at their activity, bottom line is if you look at the two maps at the bottom, these are their current Schrader Bluff sands. The in sand is shallower. The OA sand is deeper. There is zero production from the in sand right now. We have been very successful in developing the in sand at Milne Point. You can see in the OA sand, they have a lot of wells drilled, but those are on 1,200-foot spacing, meaning they're 1,200 feet apart. In Milne Point, we drill our wells 400 feet apart, which we have found more successful with the polymer flood. So a lot of opportunity for both downspacing the OA sand, drilling additional wells, and a lot that we're excited about in the in sands in applying what we've learned at Milne Point, both in completing these wells and in the polymer floods, in being able to apply at these new assets as we move forward through 2025 and beyond. And to wrap up, thank you. We look forward to continuing to responsibly produce Alaska oil and natural gas and creating Alaska jobs that contribute to the state's economy for decades to come. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fisk, for your presentation today. I will ask the committee to hold any questions and send them in an email. We can email them and then get them out to everyone else. That concludes our agenda for today. I'd like to thank our presenters today for coming and helping to keep this committee informed about their work on the slope. In wrap-up, our next meeting is Wednesday at 1 p.m., where we'll hear about the department. We'll hear from the Department of Natural Resources and the Office of the Governor about the Executive Order 136, which creates the Department of Agriculture as a new department of Alaska State Government. Resources Committee staff will also present briefly on House, I think it's HSCR1, which disapproves the executive order, and the committee will hear public testimony. The time now is 3:01 p.m., and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.